You're listening to Confessing Animals with Jen Harris and Vanessa Arrigo, rebel poets, real rebels, really talking poets, rebelling and listening.
What up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Confessing Animals podcast. I'm Jen Harris.
And I'm Vanessa Arrigo.
And I'm getting in some Tybo before this episode gets started.
I don't know. Like, I was saying my name is a very unnatural thing for some reason, because it's like, you know, like, I am Vanessa Arrigo. Like, I have my little, like, theme song, but it's like, I'm Vanessa Arrigo. Like, hey, I'm Vanessa. Like, it just, like, it sounds so strange every time I have to say my name.
Listen, I kind of like the third way that you said it. Like, if we had to vote between, like, standard Vanessa, sing with your finger in your ear, Vanessa, and just like 90s apathy, Vanessa, I'm going with the third option.
Okay, so then I get to be like a Cher and an Oprah, and I can just be Vanessa.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, sure. That sounds great. I don't know what you asked me just now, but sure. Okay, here's the deal. Let's get to the point. Today, we have an episode. Oh my God, what did we do? My brain.
We are still figuring out what we did.
I know. Am I going to call it a mini-sode, or am I going to call it a regular episode?
I don't know. This is an interlude breakthrough.
This was an unexpected conversation, and the show is only up for a limited time, so we're going to kind of post it, you know, soon, so that people will go see the show.
Yeah, I went and saw this exhibit by the artist Andrew McIlvain, Kansas City artist. I was incredibly moved by the show called Solid Poetry, and I had to get him on the show immediately to talk about it. And this is what we did today.
Right. So Andrew McIlvain is an interdisciplinary artist originally from Southern Texas and later relocated to Missouri. McIlvain makes work that explores notions such as the displacement and replacement of culture through settler colonization, identity, trauma, memory, and longing. Currently, McIlvain's practice is based in KCMO, and he holds a visiting assistant professor position in the Foundation Department at Kansas City Art Institute. So he was a fascinating character, Andrew McIlvain. And I feel very blown away by the convergence of visual art and poetry in the way that he's so specifically done it. There's like, you can tell he's a writer because there's layer on layer on layer of intentionality. Like the shit Absolutely. That gives academic critics and like literary critics their jobs, because he's the kind of person that, like, if you were to scrape off another layer, you'd find a whole different reason for this being the way it is. And it's
wild.
Oh, there's
so many layers. And to be let in on kind of the thought process and making this body of work, and the conversation he's having with ancestors, with past and present, and, you know, with ancient and modern, and with poetry and practicality. And there's so much going on there. And he was very generous with his time, with his thoughts, with he's just, you know, very open about what was going on while he was creating this work.
Yeah, I feel honored to have had him on the podcast. The exhibition Solid Poetry will be on view from October 22nd until December 18th. And that's at Plug Gallery. They're open Saturdays from 12 to 4 and by appointment. That's 1328 Agnes Avenue in Kansas City, Missouri. Check out plug.gallery. And you can go take a look at Andrew McIlvain's show, Solid Poetry. But are you ready to get into this interview?
Let's do it.
Okay.
why we've asked you here, obviously. Last weekend, I went and saw your show, Solid Poetry, at Plug Gallery. I was incredibly moved by it, so we invited you here to talk about that.
Which is so crazy. You should know, because she's got like a stone cold dead heart. So, no, I'm just kidding.
Okay, I know this is a visual art show we're talking about, and this is like an audio podcast, but you're telling such a beautiful story in your exhibition right now, and it interweaves like nature and art and poetry. It's very ethereal, but yet grounded, like in the dirt, and those are all things that we love and talk about here on the podcast. And so I was reading, in part of the description online at Plug Gallery, it describes the show as a non-linear poem filled with relationships between son and his mother. And one of the titles of your pieces is called On Earth, I'm Never Seen, But I Feel You Within Me. And for me, that evokes the poet Ocean Vuong. His book is entitled On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous, right? So I wanted to start here with the poem, with the poetry. Tell us how the poetry relates to your artistry and Solid Poetry in particular.
Yeah, I mean, again, there's like a long history in terms of like poetry being wrapped in like my family narrative. Growing up as someone who identifies as Mexican American, someone who was born in San Antonio, but, you know, moved to Missouri at a young age and was sort of uprooted from that original environment and like sort of thrusted into a new environment, which was completely different than, you know, being back in Texas. Like those were kind of two different worlds that I came from. So that for me sort of opened my mind to this idea of like having multiple perspectives. And my mom had always had like, you know, this strong relationship to being, you know, Mexican and having family that came from Mexico. And they didn't really like, I came from like a family that didn't really have a whole lot of communication. Like my mom and her parents worked all the time. So they really didn't communicate to each other. But I remember at an early age, my mom always writing poetry. And it was always something that was like late nights, she would come home from work, she would feed us, she would like take her bath and then like sit in her bed and she would write. She would write or she would read, right? And oftentimes she would like invite me or my brothers to come like on the bed and sort of like sit with her while she wrote or while she, you know, read things out loud. And so that was like the only sort of like communication I remember at an early age of like my mom sort of like talking to me about things, but not talking to me about things like very directly, but sort of like kind of giving me wisdom without really trying to preach wisdom to me. So that I was like very fond of that relationship. And that's something apparently that like she had like a strong connection to her father with. Like her father and her never really talked a whole lot, very estranged relationship. And very rough upbringing. So like the only way he sort of communicated to her a lot of times was through writing, through poems, you know, and they were always like hidden sort of away from everyone else. They were sort of something just like secretively done and spoken, kind of like Spanish for my grandparents. It was like something spoken in the house, but not something that was shared out loud. Like, you know, like those feelings that like meant a lot, but really weren't voiced. So growing up with that sort of environment, you know, I fell in love with that idea. And my dad lived in San Antonio and was, you know, sort of back and forth from prison. He spent like 20, you know, plus years in prison. So at an early age, I also didn't know my father. You know, it was hard for me to understand what my mother was. She was a single mother raising three kids by herself, moving constantly, working constantly. And never really had a break. And then I had, again, this sort of a strange relationship with my father, where I was like, I knew that this person, this entity existed, but I didn't physically know this person. So I started an early relationship with my father through like writing. He would write me from prison. And, you know, I'd write back to him. He would draw me things. I'd draw things and send it back to him. And so there was this sort of like conversation between these two individuals that really didn't know anything about each other. And it wasn't like we were sharing things. You know, I was a very young kid. So I was just like sort of reading these letters and not really thinking much about it, or looking at these images and not really thinking a whole lot about them. And as I got older, you know, those, like, that communication became lesser. You know, we moved a lot. So oftentimes, like, my father would lose contact with us. So, you know, that shut that off. And then again, my mom's working all the time, so she wasn't really talking a whole lot. So, like, growing up in that environment, you know, I, at an early age, I think I turned to drawing. I think I turned to, like, writing, you know, by myself. And I always, like, thought about it as, like, songs. Like, I didn't, like, I didn't really understand what poetry was. And I still kind of don't, right? Like, for me, poetry was sort of like...
Welcome to that club. Like, people are like, how do you write poetry? And I'm like, I don't know. Maybe I can't write whole sentences. Maybe that's actually the problem. I don't know.
Yeah, and I think that there's that, right? I think there's like a, like for me, there was an issue with like understanding like what writing was even about or like even how to write. And like that, again, translated from my mom and from her parents too. So it was like this thing that trickled down into my life. And it was so subtle and like could have been so easily missed. But I think I like sort of latched on to that idea at an early age. And so as I got older, I was, you know, writing more, I was reading more. My mom would, you know, send me letters when I like got older and was out of the house. So, you know, we're communicating through that. And so I just had like this love for this feeling, like in interacting with this thing that gave me a feeling. And oftentimes that was like these sort of like, again, hidden messages or something like that. Something that like I felt, but wasn't seen really a whole lot.
So you've interwoven this poetry into your work, but it's invitational in the way that you've experienced it, in that there, not everything is being said, but it's what it's evoking an attention, right? It's evoking a pause.
Yeah. It's absolutely like a, based on like a feeling, like I'm trying to, I guess, and yeah, very much like invoke or, you know, promote this idea of a feeling, but in a way that isn't like voiced that loud. And I think that's what like art was for me. And I think that was like a sort of self-discovery that I had this last year, was like, I had this idea of what art was. And that idea never like sort of fit with me. Like it didn't make sense. Like I was like, this thing isn't speaking the way I want it to speak. And like for this last year, there was this point of self-reflection. My mom moved to Seattle and she left with a bunch of plants with me as she, you know, moved because she couldn't, you know, take care of them. So she left. I was getting back in contact with my father and starting to communicate to him a lot. And also when my mom left, she left me like this box of like belongings, right? Things that belonged to me when I was a kid. And it was this weird sort of interaction with her too, because before she left, we talked a little bit, she gave me these plants and she gave me this box and I didn't really know what it was. And she really didn't tell me. She was just like, you know, these are your things. And I was like, what are you talking about? You know, I didn't know you had my things, you know, or what things are you talking about? And so when
have you been holding on to?
Exactly. Like, I didn't think I really had anything. So, but like everything in my life sort of fit in this small box. And as I was opening them, I was coming in contact with these things that I had lost over the years. These paintings that my dad had made when he was in prison and sent me, and these letters, you know, all these things. And it sort of jogged a bunch of memories of like interacting with those letters and interacting with those writings and hiding that too. Like at an early age, I think I was very aware that it was something that I needed to be ashamed of. Like it was something like your dad being in prison, you know, your mom being this thing that not a whole lot of people understand, you know, was very confusing. So I think I would look at those things every once in a while. I'd open them up. I'd unfold the like bandana paintings and, you know, look at them and think about them. And then I'd fold them back up quickly and like tuck them away in my like underwear drawer and just like push them back. And when I got them again, when my mom left, I found myself doing the same thing. Like I'd look at them and I'd like be in awe of them and I'd read them and I would think about them. And then I would fold them up and like tuck them away. And as I was spending more time with them, like it didn't make any sense why I was hiding them. I was like, why am I like doing this? Like, why was I doing this then? And why am I still doing it now? I needed to like kind of live with them. So I ended up taking those paintings and drawings and hanging them in my studio, like pinning them to the wall so that I had to like be forced to look at them always, like always think about them, always be around them. And I started to fall in love with them more. And I found that like I was falling in love with my father and my mother through these things. Like it was like they were always around even when I didn't think they were around. Like, again, I was taking care of my mom's plants after she left. And I was realizing that at that time I was sort of like nurturing myself with these memories of her. as I was trying to make this thing continue to live. And that was like a sort of poetic like thing that I was thinking about, like, that's life. Like, well, all we're doing is sort of like nurturing ourselves and nurturing these memories as a means of like holding on to this thing that we're always longing to have around us. And again, I was reading a lot of Gloria Anzaldúa. I was reading Octavio Paz, Lozano. And I was also reading Ocean Vuong's On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous. And I was like finding these connections to these authors and, you know, in a way that I never thought. Like these people were sort of speaking to my soul. Like the things that they were writing were the things that I was thinking constantly. And like, that was also like this sort of weird soul connection of being like, oh, I'm not alone. Like I grew up my whole life thinking I was just like isolated. Like just no one got me, no one understood me, no one saw me, no one like really like heard me.
And it's then such a breakthrough. Like yeah. when you see yourself reflected back to you, and especially work that's written so many years before you. And I remember having that experience reading Anais Nin's diaries. I was like reading myself and it opened this world to me. It's like, you now have access to something you did not have access to before.
Having lived before feels like very relieving to me. I'm like, oh, new shit. Okay. Keep going. I'm clear on it now, you know, but it took a long time.
Yeah. I think, and that's one of those weird things too. I was like thinking about, it's like the generations this has had to like go through in order for someone to see it, like in order for someone to like understand what was happening there was like a sort of a realization too. And Ocean Vuong talks about that in terms of like this generational movement and this generational like dialogue between those different generations and how these things are passed on to each other in a way that isn't like, again, visible. Like you don't, it's something that sticks to you without you thinking about it sticking to you. And yeah, so that really like inspired a lot of the work. I was going back to Mexico and I was thinking about things too, thinking about my grandparents, like where they came from, what they had to do in order to kind of get to this new space in order to like, for them, I think they didn't like, they knew they weren't going to succeed in that space. Like it wasn't going to be them. It was going to be the next generation or hopefully the generation after that or the generation after that. Like there was like this self-sacrifice of identity and culture and language and, you know, all these things as a means of like pushing this thing forward, trying to get out of a space.
So what an incredible courageousness to embrace, to be, you know, to be the breaking wave. Like that's such an incredibly powerful thing to be the foundational aspect of your family's experience.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. I mean, honestly, and it's, I don't know, you know, I honestly don't know if it's like even my generation. Like I still don't feel like it's me that understands it quite yet. Maybe it'll be the next generation, you know, if it makes it that far. Like, but it was like a really cool thing to think about in terms of like feeling connected to these people that I didn't really think that, like my mom is my mom. I love my mom, but it's like, you know, I don't talk to my mom that much, you know, like I don't really even understand who she is. And it like dawned on me that I didn't understand where she came from. I didn't understand why we were where we were, where she came from and where her parents came from. And it was something that spoken. It was something like that was like just passed on till someone I think could absorb it enough to like reflect on it.
And when you step into your exhibit, when you step into the gallery to see Solid Poetry, you don't have to know anything about your story or your background. You can feel that you're stepping into a feeling. I think you describing poetry as a feeling is just perfect because you're stepping into this feeling, into this experience that you can tell a story is being told there. You can tell there's connection there. You can see history and lineage. And it's like, and I can't describe it in words because again, it wasn't words. I didn't know anything about the show when I arrived, but it's like, you can feel all of that. You know what I mean? And it's like, you can see the story is being told. And then when I came home and I read the titles and I read what the description was on the website, you know, and started piecing it all together, like, you can see that conversation you're having. And with writing the letters to your dad, like not really knowing him, but knowing him through the written word, it's like the way we form relationships, like when we're reading poetry and when reading literature, like we don't know these people, but we feel connected to them, right? And it's like, there's so many connections through the whole show. And one of the main first visual things you see is yellow. Like, color is really important in your work, because I know you had a series before this that was like all blue. And now this one is like yellow is the main point. And I was wondering, like, what is this, an intentional gesture, or like, what is the color doing for the work?
Yeah, I think, color is like a big part of, like, I think symbolism and how I play it into my work. Again, it's like that sort of that hidden conversation with someone, like, color can mean a lot. Color was like very intentional for me. I had that series of blue works, like the monochromatic blue and white, that was sort of like part one of this, like, this narrative that I was playing around with. And for me, that work was like a reflection of a lot of things. It was a sort of a subtle conversation about the settler, like, colonialism that was going on in Central America. So, like, after the Spanish conquistadors had conquered the Aztecs, you know, a lot of, like, new things started to shift in that space. Specifically, colors started to shift. So you start to see a lot of blue and white ceramics that come into place. And this is something that comes from, like, Eastern Asia, that traveled from Eastern Asia to Spain, from Spain to Central America, again, through that conquest. But there was like these, and like even terracotta, how it went from like ground level to like rooftops, and like this elevation of a material based on status. Like if you were, you know, higher up in, you know, culture, you got this bigger house with this nice terracotta tiles. And you see it in Kansas City too. It's like a subtle thing. But I was noticing these things, and yellow became part of that too. So when I'd made my last body of work, Movement, which was like the series title, I was in like a huge depression. So I went through like a 6 to 9 month long depression, which is like the biggest depression I've ever experienced. Like, I've always been someone who struggled with that, but I'd never been like submerged into this space of like so much self-doubt and like lack of confidence and like lack of focus in terms of what I was doing. And I think a lot of that was like, I was investigating my family, and like, again, I sort of like realized the story that was going on, and like saw these things that were being passed on to each generation, and each generation struggling with the same thing, like, and not like being able to move past it. Like, it was like things were being recycled each time. And like, there was this sort of like constant struggle of like trauma, both again, in regards to identity, but like, you know, just everything, like culture, language, all these things just being recycled. And so there was a realization within that body of work where I was like, oh shit, these things that I felt as a kid are real. Like, the things that people said to me when I was a kid are real. Like, being, you know, as a kid, you know, someone who identifies as Mexican American, and having both the Spanish and the indigenous is part of like my identity. So it's like, I have both blood in me, and oftentimes they're like sort of conflicting with each other. They argue against each other. There's this part that wants to make me white, and there's this part that wants to make me brown. And some days I wake up and I feel brown. Some days I wake up, I feel white. And sometimes that happens throughout the day, and like during situations, during different environments I'm in. And part of like that is like sort of blending in, is like survival. And even, you know, thinking about why my mom gave me this last name, you know, this conversation that comes up all the time. I didn't understand it until this last year. You know, I didn't understand it until having conversations with my mom of like what that meant. Like, why this name rather than this name? Like, why give me something? Is to push me further out, is to get me like further away from this thing, to kind of help me get to a higher space. So after that depression, I stopped making work for a little bit, and I was just writing, thinking, you know, I was making music. I was just trying to like get back in the mindset of like it's okay. Like, I that's the realization. I have to deal with the realization, and I had to like move on. So part of that was color. Like, I was like, I was gardening a lot. Again, I was taking care of my mom's plants, and I was playing around with a lot of terracotta. And I was thinking about these things that were warm, like warm in color, but warm in feeling, like, and how to promote that and sort of, an installation, or, you know, how to immerse someone in that feeling. How do I like get myself out of this blue feeling? I needed to go the opposite in the color wheel. I needed to jump to the opposite of that feeling. And I needed to make things warm. I needed to feel like bright again. I needed to like bring that color back. And so yellow orange and red are the colors that are sort of played throughout the work, but as well as the green. And so I was thinking about analogous colors and analogous relationships. Like, what's the purpose of an analogous relationship? It's to like build context from this thing to this thing. Like, there's an in-between. We oftentimes don't see the in-between, so we don't connect these two things that seem opposite of each other. So I was
And to that point, how you are utilizing like the symbolism of the Nike symbol or these kind of modern pop culture imagery, and you're utilizing that in juxtaposition with natural elements, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And even like, again, playing both sides, like, so there's that piece that's held up by balance that's in between, and it's titled In Between. And on the left side, there's a Toltec symbol for Earth. And again, the Toltec people are an ancient civilization from Mesoamerica, sort of that predate the Aztecs and Maya. They come after the Olmec. But that's a symbol for Earth. And I was like thinking about that connection to like how, where I am now. Like, I'm still this thing, but I'm now this new thing. I was born in this space and I have to like survive in this space. And I was thinking about my connection to Nike and like these symbols that I interact with. And I was thinking about like status too. I think in like the age that we live in, like a subtle symbol can mean a lot. For me, Nike was always that thing. I was fascinated as a kid, you know, it was the sports. It was like something that elevated someone, like putting on a pair of shoes, like fucking elevated this person, like made them seem like a god. And so they were closer to heaven in that regard. But I was also seeing like how this thing could be like shaped from this thing. Like, we see Nike as this clean symbol, but it kind of came from this thing that was more rigid in nature.
Yeah, I loved that. When I was viewing it, I was like, you know, I immediately could see that it was juxtaposing against the Nike symbol because it's similar in shape and style. But like, I was like, what is it? Like, I thought it was a whale, like I, not knowing what it was, but I knew that it was like playing off each other. And it was so fascinating to me. Like, again, just like the modern and the ancient and the use of the Home Depot rulers, like you could, as frames, like you can still see that it says Home Depot and the rulers on there. Like, what was the reason behind like keeping that visible?
Girl, you know, it's just because we're all broke.
Yeah.
Don't try to make this philosophical. No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead. It's a bad question.
No, I mean, honestly, that's part of it, Jen. Like, there's this idea of like elevating something that isn't elevated, right? And I think we come in contact with this a lot in like the fine arts specifically. Like, even this idea of something that's archival or archivable, like something that can exist for longer, something that's like immortal, something that will never die. And I think this is something that artists are always obsessed with. It's like, and curators and galleries are always thinking about this too, is like, how can this work live and how can we keep it alive, right? And I was like thinking, I was reflecting about like the things that I was falling in love with. And I was like, I'm falling in love with these things that are natural and I'm natural and I'm not going to live forever. Like, why am I trying to create this thing that's going to live forever? What's the point in that? What's the beauty in that? Like, I don't relate to that. I can't be that. That's this impossible task. And that started playing in with these like ideas of pressure and expectations. And I wanted to go against those. And I think the Home Depot ruler played into that. It was like this thing that was like a subtle conversation again about like how something can be elevated if you put it on, you know, in like your peripherals. So you hide it out of focus, right? So it looks like a frame up front, but when you get to the side, there's also, again, some like hidden context for that thing. So you had to move out of your way in order to view this thing in the way that I wanted you to view it. And it was also like a sort of subtle conversation about like day labor too. Having like, you know, been someone who's worked construction and someone who's worked in, you know, the restaurant industry as well. And in all these sort of spaces in between. And as I was getting, as I got my new house or my house, this past year during COVID, you know, I'm a first generation homeowner. So I like purchased a house with my wife and it was like this big moment. Cause I never thought I was going to be able to do this thing. You know, I grew up living in, you know, mostly apartments, you know, some home rentals every once in a while, at times like hotels and at times in cars. So it's like, I had sort of existed in all these spaces and this was always this thing that I wanted to achieve and I finally achieved it. And as
congratulations.
I just want to say congratulations because that's a huge thing. Like most people cannot be homeowners and yeah, I mean, that's a huge step.
Yeah, it was, and again, I was like crossing privileges too. So like there was this like realization where I was like, oh, I made it. But like, I was also like sort of mourning like this idea of like, maybe, not maybe I shouldn't have made it, but like, what does that now mean? Like, I'm in this new space again. Like, what does that mean now?
I like going back to the Home Depot rulers though, because it's also like a nod to like, to work and something like functional, right? Yeah. Like a lot of people look at art as like this privileged or this elevated thing, but then like Home Depot and rulers are very like practical, functional tools, right? Like,
yeah. Well, they don't realize we're like thinking of these, we're thinking of these crafts, of these art, of these projects while we're doing these other jobs, while we're doing this other labor, our minds are wandering to these things that we would rather be creating and will eventually, but still, I think the presence of that is it speaks across multitudes.
Yeah, yeah. And just the conversation that each piece is having with each other, like the on one of the bandanas, there's a drawing of like a necklace, and then it's like that same necklace is like hung on one of the sculptures, yeah. And you know, you see these repetition of like the gold coins or the gold rocks and the yellow and the sun and the stairs. So the pedestals that like the vessels are on, right? Mm-hmm. Like they have like, they're cut out and stair-like. And then the sculptures that are on the wall also like mimic that same stair, like motif.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. And like, there are like things that I was, again, coming in contact with when I was going to Mexico. Color was a big part of it. Like I didn't really think about cobalt blue until I went back to Mexico and sort of like saw this thing everywhere, like existing in mosaics, and Frida Kahlo's house is painted in cobalt blue in Mexico City. There are all these things, right? And they're subtle. You had to like dig, you had to excavate like these things in order to understand what sort of existed in them. And I always saw like time as like linear. I think most people do, but then it was like, I was starting to see that time was like stacked. It was like more vertical than it was linear. Like I was reading it wrong. Like it was, and maybe it was both. Maybe it was like this nonsensical thing that we couldn't understand or didn't try to understand quite right. But yeah, the pedestals are just step frets. So you see them a lot in Mexico. They're a symbol of like afterlife. They're oftentimes used in like funeral, like imagery. It's a connection to also like a lot of indigenous cultures. So you see it in the Olmec, you see it passed down to the Toltec, and you see it get passed into the Mayan culture as well as the Aztec culture. And it sometimes moves up and it sometimes moves down, and sometimes it will actually move up and down or around. So it's talking about movement, and it's sort of talking about like the cyclical cycle of life, like how we sort of start a thing and end a thing, but we sometimes end a thing right where we started. Like what exists after death? I think more life. Like if you look around, everything just lives in this cyclical cycle. Everything is just dying and growing and dying and growing and dying and growing. And that's what we're bound to on the earth. So it was like this sort of spiritual conversation I was having. I was, again, just doing a lot of research based on that. And like, yeah, just thinking about that movement, like the movement that I've experienced in my life, the movement that my mom experienced, the movement that her parents experienced. And that kind of connected again to the butterflies too. It was like, I was thinking of Ocean Vuong, and I was thinking about, you know, the monarch's migration, taking three generations to get to this space, and like realizing that these butterflies move without like knowing that they're never going to make it. Like that first generation takes flight knowing that it's not going to be the generation that makes it to their destination. It's not the second generation, you know, it's the third generation that finally makes it. And then after they die, oftentimes they give birth to a super breed that is able to make that whole generation in one continuous movement. So make it from the United States back to Mexico without dying ever. So one generation, it takes three generations to do this thing that this one generation can do after it's born. And I was feeling connected to that, being a third generation immigrant. I was like, well, I was this fucking third thing that could finally move freely. Like it took all this movement to get me here. And I was like sad about that. I think when I was a kid, like I didn't understand it. I didn't like it. I didn't, you know, want to be that, you know? And then I was like realizing there was a lot of strength in that. Like I had to find the beauty in those things. And that was like, again, sort of brought me to the title where I was like, there are these realizations I was having, and I was like, fuck, that's solid poetry. Like that's this idea of like Like that's it. That's life. It's like, it's solid poetry. It's just, you have to like be aware of it. And that's what the Toltecs like spiritually were talking about. They talked about these four like agreements, these like four conversations we have. And these are based on direction. So in any space that you're in, you have four directions you can travel, right? You have four perspectives that you can possibly, or four destinations you can possibly take. And within that, you have like four agreements that you have, right? So you have the agreement with yourself, you have the agreement with others, you have the agreement with gods, and you have the agreement with the earth. So you have to have this conversation with all those things in order to move freely. And the Toltecs, honestly, the way that they like spiritually were organized, they saw life as poetry. They saw life as like a dream that was just filled with like spiritual connections, but you had to be aware of it. You had to like see all the directions in order to move it.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Confessing Animals Podcast. To check out Andrew's show at Plug Gallery, plug.gallery online, and that's in Kansas City. The exhibition will be on view until December 18th. Also, check out Andrew's website at andrewmcilvaine.com, M-C-I-L-V-A-I-N-E, and on Instagram at Andrew McIlvaine.